Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies. You can study a variety of topics such as creative writing, human rights, and the arts. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What happens to children with mental health issues in mainstream classrooms? In the best of circumstances, such students are professionally diagnosed and given the therapy they need to cope and succeed in school. But as many educators will attest, those resources are often financially unavailable to students outside of school and in critically short supply in schools, leaving teachers who may have little or no mental health training to deal with students whose problems may disrupt the progress of an entire class. As a psychiatrist herself, my guest today is aware of that reality and wanted to offer teachers some strategies to help them understand the behavior of students who struggle with mental health issues and guide them to more productive and acceptable classroom conduct. Dr. Nancy Rappaport is assistant professor of psychiatry at Harvard Medical School and co-author, along with Jessica Minahan, of The Behavior Code, a practical guide to understanding and teaching the most challenging students. Nancy, welcome back to Think.
I'm so happy to be talking with you again, Chris.
This is a really unique book in that you acknowledge that students with mental health problems are unquestionably best served by a team of experts, but also in the real world, you recognize those services are not always available to students who need them. And so often teachers are taking matters into their own hands anyway.
Again, we're so fortunate in America that we have a lot of people that will mobilize to provide support to students. But at the same time, particularly kindergarten through sixth grade, a lot of times a teacher is in the classroom on a bad day battling it out with a student. And what we wanted to say is we have students that we have experience with that we want to make a practical book so that it has grounded in some of the understanding we may have about behavior, but helps with a teacher or a parent about what do you need to do tomorrow. So the behaviors that we looked at were anxiety, oppositional behavior, a kid who's being belligerent, withdrawn behavior, and sexualized behavior. And we chose those because it's in those settings where sometimes adults in kids' lives can make incorrect assumptions about what's driving the behavior. Mm-hmm. And so we wanted to provide some guidelines.
And you also take pains here to stress that students with mental health issues are not bad kids. They are not behaving because they can't behave.
Right. The premise is that kids would behave if they could, and our job as adults is to be able to give them the skill set and to build the relationship so that they can thrive. And I do safety assessments, which are intensive psychiatric assessments when schools are questioning about whether a child's safe to be in school. And oftentimes I would see older students who were blowing out of school, quite frankly, mm-hmm. and I would feel like if only we could have come in earlier. And that's why I teamed up with Jess, because Jess is a behavioral analyst and spends a lot of her energy in the classroom. And I had a student who I wrote an article called From Zero to 100 in a Split Second, which is the way that the principal described this little boy. And I could see some of the ways that Jess approached this student and put in things into place. And I thought, you know what, we have a lot to learn together and wanted to share that with teachers.
And in a class of 20 students, Nancy, statistically, there will nearly always be a child or two that has these special needs.
That's unfortunately the situation that we're in now. And in some ways, sometimes people will say, and that's partly why we called our plan, which we call the FAIR plan, which is an acronym, but it was also that sometimes teachers may feel, if we can just get rid of this kid, mm-hmm. then we should be able to teach and give the academics that are necessary for the other kids, and the other kids are paying a price. And our feeling was, there's going to be another student that comes around the corner, so let's think about how you can front-load your effort and turn this behavior around so you're not terrorized for the whole year walking on eggshells.
So let's talk a little bit about the FAIR plan, which, as you mentioned, is an acronym. The first letter, the F, stands for functional hypothesis. What does that mean?
Can you believe I went from writing a book about my mother to the FAIR plan? But F is about the function of the behavior. And again, that's a behaviorist way of looking at it, but it's saying that behavior is communication, and that in Duran, who's a developmental psychologist, that you can pretty much simplify the behavior to being motivated for four reasons. And those are for attention, escape, sensory, because you like the way it feels, taste, and then for tangible. You want what you want when you want it, or you want that object. Mm-hmm. And what can sometimes happen with adults when they're working with kids is they can jump to an assumption which may be misguided and then build an intervention that's meant to teach the child how to behave differently, but because they haven't understood what the function of the behavior is, it doesn't work. So if I give you a quick example, a kid who pushes a child off of the computer, you might think, okay, this is a little this little student has trouble with sharing, and I need to give him a, you know, quick reprimand about you need to share the computer, and that's a lifelong lesson I'm still trying to learn. But maybe this is a kid with really poor social skills, mm-hmm. and what he, you know, he has Asperger's or autism, and what he's really trying to do is actually make a friend and get the attention of the other student. So that's an example of where understanding the function, one is teaching to share, the other one is bolstering social skills and how you make a friend.
And again, that same action, depending on the student, could mean something entirely different. It could be for attention. It could also be, I mean, so in other words, it's not even a matter of saying, okay, what is all shoving away from the computer, because it depends on the student's particular situation.
Right. And so we talk about that, and we understand that teachers have enormous demands. So we're trying to say, just for these particular kids, take this time because it's going to pay off. So if you look at the antecedents or what goes on before the incidents that's happening and the consequences, you're going to have a much better chance at intervening. And so often what I've seen over the years, and I've been working in schools for 20 years consulting, is that when something happens, people tend to focus on the incident. So we even have things called incident reports in schools, which have enormous detail around what happened in the escalating moment. But we're saying look for patterns. And so, for instance, another thing that schools sometimes do inadvertently is if a child says a rude sexual comment in the class, they're banished to the principal right away. What if the child has figured out, if I want to get out of math, the way I get out of math is I say something rude, and then I get to go to the principal's office. Then our response as a school has inadvertently reinforced the behavior.
So you talk about this thing, and you just mentioned it with the word antecedent, about ABC note-taking to look for these patterns. How does that work exactly? Because sometimes the antecedent, it may be what happened 5 seconds before, and it may be what happened 5 hours before when the student had a really bad morning at home.
Yes, and that's important. There are what we call setting points that may be that a child came in, there was a fight at home, or there was were late for the school bus, and so those things are possible. But then there may be, for instance, a child who has anxiety. What we say about that is they may actually have irregular patterns where you're looking for the antecedent and you're looking for what happened before, but actually these are the kids where they may not come to school with A stamped on their forehead, and so they explode, and the teacher ends up walking on eggshells because there is no pattern. But other times, just by going through the exercise of writing down four or five, and we try to give examples to show it, four or five times when an incident may happen, you can begin to see patterns. And so, for instance, with an explosive kid, it may be around transitions. So mm-hmm. we'll talk about, well, how do you manage transitions? Or maybe you'll notice that the student is decompensating at the end of the day, and that it's actually that the lunch is a triggering time, and what you need to do is to do an alternative lunch. So what we're trying to do with the behavior code is get people to be detectives, to get a little bit detached, step back, and begin to analyze what's happening. And it's easy for me to say because I've been a teacher for a small amount of time in my life, but when you're in the classroom, you're under siege a lot.
Yeah.
And especially when you have a kid that's acting up.
And one thing that can be a challenge with a kid who's acting up is developing a solid relationship. But over and over and over in the book, it comes up that relationships are particularly important to these children.
Yes, I'm so glad you bring that up because I am a psychiatrist and relationships should have a role. and that's to say that sometimes you have kids who, when they come into the classroom, they've had such an experience, behavioral analysts like to call error history, where they anticipate that a teacher isn't going to like them. And one of the hardest things that I've seen over the years is if a student decides that a teacher, quote-unquote, hates me, they will make it their mission to undermine the teacher.
Yeah.
And so we're really encouraging it's those particular kids that you almost have to make an extra effort to try to build a relationship, because I've seen over the years that there'll be, you know, a teacher who is sort of triggering for a student, and you'll see their worst behavior. And we're trying to say sometimes what you have to do is to catch the student being good, that you're so primed to know that little Johnny is going to be doing X, Y, and Z that you may miss those opportunities. So, again, you know, collaborating with Jess, it was the practical strategy. She has teachers sometimes put safety pins in their pocket and move the safety pin from one side to the other side when they've given their child a compliment, just to concretize that and help them, you know, focus on that.
And sometimes, especially with kids who have oppositional behaviors, you say it's important to praise intermittently so that they never quite know when they will be praised. The kids almost don't figure it out and learn to sort of game the system.
So, you know, again, it's also that we don't want to overdo the praise and then have kids become inured to it, bored by it, and take it for granted. So that intermittent reinforcement. But my favorite piece that I love about working with oppositional or belligerent kids is what we call random acts of kindness.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember in a different context when I was talking around suicide that a man had said when he was crossing the Golden Gate Bridge that if anybody had smiled at him, he wasn't going to jump. That's a random act of kindness. It's just showing that you like someone for who they are, not what they're doing. So you give little Johnny a sticker because you were just thinking about them, or you bring in their favorite magazine about cars just to let them know that I'm not getting fooled, that you need to be cared about.
My guest is Dr. Nancy Rappaport. She's assistant professor of psychiatry at Harvard Medical School and co-author of the new book, The Behavior Code, a practical guide to understanding and teaching the most challenging students. We'll resume the conversation in a couple of minutes. If you'd like to join us, you can call 1-800-933-5372, or you can send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, a multidisciplinary program that allows you the intellectual freedom to design your own master's degree. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Assistant Professor of Psychiatry at Harvard Medical School, Dr. Nancy Rappaport. Her new book, written with Jessica Minahan, is called The Behavior Code, A Practical Guide to Understanding and Teaching the Most Challenging Students. Join this conversation by calling 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org. So, Nancy, some of the accommodations that you suggest to teachers in the behavior code, things like an extra sticker now and then or a word of praise, might pass by in the classroom without the other students taking note. On the other hand, other accommodations like allowing particular students to retreat to what you call a safe space or to play with Play-Doh if they're very stressed out on a particular day when everybody else is doing fractions, those kinds of things will sometimes cause the other students to say, hey, what gives here? How do you suggest teachers explain without necessarily going into their functional hypothesis of what this particular student needs that they don't need?
You know, I think straightforward language. Kids already know that these are students that may be struggling.
Yeah.
And just to be able to say, you know, this is what little Mary will say now. You know, little Mary needs to learn. Mm-hmm. And, you know, just, and sometimes you can follow it up, you know, just that the way that you may need to wear glasses or someone else needs a wheelchair. These are things that are going to help them function better.
You know, that's such a great point because kids will be the first ones to tell you who in their class is not behaving the way the other kids do. They notice.
And they get exhausted by it.
Mm-hmm.
So part of it, too, is that we're trying to put in strategies that will help with what we call replacement behaviors in order to keep the peace while we build the skill levels.
What's a replacement behavior?
So replacement behavior, for instance, would mean if you have a kid with sexualized behavior, there's someone with social skill difficulties who sort of has figured out, someone with Asperger's or autism, who's figured out, you know what, if I make a sexual joke that gets me a lot of attention,
mm-hmm.
and they haven't really expanded their repertoire about how might they connect. So you give them a joke book to teach them how to do fun jokes that are more appropriate. And that's a replacement behavior. So that you're, or you have a kid who decides that escaping from the classroom is and getting into a knockdown fight with the teacher is the way to avoid having to do math, and that they get really anxious about math. And so while you're helping bring in more resources to get their skill level up with math, you may have them rehearse and learn how to ask for a break in a more appropriate way. Maybe they have a flashcard that says, you know, that's a green card that means that they're getting the break, but they're finding an alternative way to communicate it at the time while you're trying to build the skill level. So replacement behavior can work quickly. Skills building can take longer time.
In a way, we're talking about this subject throughout the entire hour, Nancy, but I wonder how you think discipline standards and application should differ for students who have mental health problems as compared with their neurotypical classmates.
So there's a whole host of legal questions around that, which is in terms of the disciplinary procedure that once you've accumulated 10 days of detentions or suspensions, that you do what's called a functional behavioral analysis, and you try, hopefully you can do it earlier, but really trying to figure out, is the behavior secondary to a psychiatric diagnosis, and if so, do we modify the discipline code? So, you know, sometimes you do want to introduce accountability, and you don't want to, kind of excuse away behavior, and that's certainly not anything that, you know, either Jess and I would support. But you want to be able to really focus on how can we help shape this behavior as teachers. And quite frankly, detentions and suspensions, when there's, you know, it's good for giving the teacher or the principal a break,
mm-hmm.
from the drama of what's going on, but particularly, there have been studies by Atkins that show that with hostile, impulsive kids, you actually can sometimes see an increase in their behavior, which ends up leading more to more detention suspensions. So sometimes your sort of neurotypical kid or may give them one detention, and that's a devastating consequence.
Yeah.
But Other kids, you know, particularly if, say, there's abuse going on at home that where they've been, you know, had some kind of violations that have gone on, you know, detention and suspensions are not what's going to change their behavior.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. First on the line this afternoon, we have Skip in McKinney. Hi, Skip. Skip, are you with us? Okay, we will move on there. We have an email here. This one's from Sam. Sam says, I was wondering if I should, if I could find out what is the earliest age parents should start correcting their child. We have a baby who just turned one and is showing some behavioral issues. I know this is a little outside the scope of K through six, but I'm sure you have an idea about this, Nancy.
Sure. Well, 1 year old probably wouldn't. Well, the touching part about that is it makes me imagine that this is a first-time parent.
Mm-hmm.
You know, certainly what this your listener is highlighting is that even as, you know, young as 6 months to a year, how we respond to a child does shape their behavior. So I don't think you want to be, you know, disciplining a one-year-old because you don't have the, you know, the one-year-old doesn't understand consequences, and really you need to, like if you use a timeout, they say for three-year-old, if you give them a timeout, you want to make it 3 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, their sense of time is really, you know, very short. But with a small baby, depending on how you respond to their normal kind of sleep routine where they may wake up and fuss a little bit, you know, you have the new parent that kind of rushes in and picks them up and thinks they might be on the edge of a cliff and then slowly begin to realize, you know what, if I give this little baby more time, they'll probably be able to self-soothe and get themselves to sleep. So, you know, this is a wonderful example of showing how our responses can shape a baby or a child's behavior.
Back to the phones now. It looks like we've restored our connection to Skip in McKinney. Hey, Skip.
Yes.
Hi.
How are you doing? Chris, and I thought you were starting to frame the question that I had in my mind was, and this, it's a two-part question. One is that with all this, what this author is talking about in terms of what a teacher should do, shouldn't do, watch out for, not watch out for, keep track of, it strikes me that a public school teacher, public school system is already heavily overloaded with all the other requirements it has. How does a public school system start this program up or continue to do better at it? And I think the second one is that it would be a good question to ask about how the whole system, private or public, can take care of children like this in a high school situation. I mean, you talk about little Mary or little Jimmy, but maybe it's a high schooler who's struggling with an Asperger's or an undiagnosed condition like that. So two different questions.
Thanks for your call.
Thank you, Skip. So the first question is about how teachers are overloaded with requirements, and I certainly hope that when, you know, if you have a chance to take a look at the book or any teachers, that you'll recognize that we have tried to write this with enormous empathy. And our last chapter is actually about self-care and how important that is for teachers and that they are our heroes and heroines because they are, you know, shaping the future for our children. And that what happens is when you have disruptive kids who are explosive, they're already draining your effort to meet the requirements. So we're really trying to come up with some solutions that will allow, free up teachers. So what you're right to be pointing out is that, yes, we are saying that you have to front load this and think very preventatively about how you can make interventions so that you're not becoming very discouraged about persistent behavior. And I think we lose a lot of new teachers because they come in with all the best intentions, and then they're confronted with these types of behaviors, and it scares them off, quite frankly.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's our investment, is to say, you know, we don't want to lose great teachers. And difficult behavior can drive teachers out of the system because they'll say, we aren't paid enough to do this kind of work. And then the second question you asked was about private or public in high school struggling, say, with Asperger's or undiagnosed aspects. And certainly my work, I've worked 20 years in a school-based health center with teenagers, and the work doesn't stop with elementary school kids. Our book was focused more, although some of my colleagues say that the chapter on anxiety is useful for high school folks. Mm-hmm. We chose to look at elementary school because that's where teachers do want to make the investment, because they are sometimes 4 to 6 hours with a student, and that can be a very long day.
This doesn't come up specifically in the book, Nancy, but I'm guessing it might be something that you have come across throughout your career. Sometimes there is that student who, you know, starting in kindergarten has had some problems and up on through, and by the time, you know, that child arrives in third or fourth grade, he or she has a reputation. Is there a better way for teachers to frame the way they talk about these students that they may recognize as troubled and may have had problems with, so that the next teacher to take this student on isn't unfairly biased against that student?
It's an excellent question, and something that Jess and I talked about together, because on the one hand, you know, Jess's orientation is that there's sometimes can be a tremendous amount of gossiping that can go on in the teacher's lunchroom, mm-hmm. and that it kind of can create a mythical lore about a student so that they're sort of doomed before they get there. And those are the particular kids that we would say you really want to invest in a relationship early on, because they are anticipating rejection and that they will maybe make moves to, and teachers do this all the time. I do safety assessments, so I'll talk with kids who their eyes will light up when they talk about one particular teacher that they had that managed to climb over the brick wall that said, stay away from me. I guess it's to take everything with a grain of salt. There's many times that I have read charts that are, you know, 2 feet tall, and then I come in and it's pretty powerful how much students really long to have a connection.
And sometimes you write that connection can start with something like humor. You give the example of a really oppositional kid who says, I'm not going to art. And instead of, you know, getting into a battle of wits, the teacher says, well, you know, don't make me carry you. Get up and walk down the hall.
That is a great strategy. And I have to say for Skip, that's a great strategy to use with teenagers. With people who are going to press your buttons, if you can kind of step back, sometimes, you know, when parents are in the midst of a battle with their kids, to be able to sort of even just step in the bathroom for a moment and take a break and, you know, make space at yourself kind of allows you to regroup. And the part we carefully worded around the humor is, and in that example, you want to be careful that you don't shame the person with the humor.
Yeah.
So it's a fine line between trying to make things just a little bit lighter at the same time as maintaining your connection with that person.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next on the phones to Cindy in Fort Worth. Hi, Cindy.
Hi. Glad to talk to you. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
The question I have is about mainstreaming. I don't know when this became popular. I'm thinking it was about 30 years ago, where they started putting special education needs children, mainstreaming them into the normal public education system. And I'm wondering if that's really working out well, because the teachers in the classroom don't have the training for the students who may be anywhere from Downs to Asperger's to autistic to attention deficit, all these other types of issues. And yet these are causing problems for the classroom. So I'm wondering, wasn't it a better model to have these kids to have special education classes and needs? Because I happen to have had a special education needs student, and really the school really didn't do anything except kind of dumb things down for them and not really try to teach them to cope with their particular handicap. And then I have a lot of other parents that are telling me the same thing. They spend all their time fighting with the schools to try to see that their kids get what they want. And in the classroom, these kids are often targets for bullying. In fact, my daughter specifically mentioned a situation where there was a kid in her class who was obviously special needs that the class was picking on. And so I'm just wondering that the education system we have right now, the whole idea where we're trying to mix a whole bunch of people in one class, some of them are special needs, some of them are gifted and talented, some of them are slow learners, and is that really a good model?
What do you think, Nancy?
So, Cindy, you have your finger on the pulse of educational debate. Congratulations, because that's been a 30-year debate about sort of tracking, and now you're talking about a different kind of tracking than, you know, educational. And, you know, there are times when a child will have so much challenge that being in a classroom where there's a smaller student-teacher ratio can be of benefit. And, you know, sometimes you have a self-contained classroom that can have, you know, 8 students and 1 teacher, and they're able to provide enough instruction to, as you so well said, not to dumb things down, but to really provide enough support so that the extra time that a student needs is given and the type of specialized instruction happens. And, you know, sometimes there are kids who've had enough kinds of challenges. Maybe they've been sexually abused as a child and they're absolutely raging and it's just too difficult, or have, you know, very significant bipolar disorder and are so irritable and have such swings that it's easier to be in a therapeutic school setting. That said, sometimes you can put those kids in what's called a self-contained setting, meaning a room with lots of kids with behavioral difficulties, and they feed off of each other. And I would say that where we agree is I do think that we moved towards including these kids in the classroom and didn't provide the kind of support and explicit instructions to teachers to help them manage the behavior. And that's why we wrote the book, was to say, you know what, teachers deserve this. Some special educators have this, and we want teachers to have it too.
The book is called The Behavior Code, A Practical Guide to Understanding and Teaching the Most Challenging Students. Its author is Dr. Nancy Rappaport, Assistant Professor of Psychiatry at Harvard Medical School. Co-author of the book is Jessica Minahan. We'll come back to our conversation with Dr. Rappaport in just a moment. If you'd like to join us, the number is 1-800-933-5372. Email address is think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, a graduate education flexible enough to allow you to explore what matters most to you. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest is Dr. Nancy Rappaport, Assistant Professor of Psychiatry at Harvard Medical School and co-author of The Behavior Code, A Practical Guide to Understanding and Teaching the Most Challenging Students. Nancy, talk about this. What do you recommend to parents who are aware of their children's mental health issues, want to communicate with teachers, but don't know going in how much mental health education these teachers have had, how willing they will be to recognize their children's limitations and strengths?
Oh, what a terrific question. First, one of our dreams would be that they could actually get our book and highlight with yellow marker and say, you know what, these are some things we think would be helpful for our child, because these are concrete strategies where you don't have to get into a lot of information about the diagnosis.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, what I've noticed over the years is information is power. So sometimes if a parent is in a power struggle with the school, they'll kind of withhold information as a way of trying to hold on to what minimal power they feel like they have. So, you know, it's so important to have a collaboration with your school. And yet, sometimes what can happen in the school setting is parents can be indignant and feel that the school is withholding resources for their child, and then it gets to be a battle. So, you know, that I guess what I'm saying is if there's a sense of collaboration, then sharing information about what works and doesn't work is a much more fluid process. And there are opportunities for dialogue, particularly if they have an individual ed plan, which is when there is something that's diagnosed in the federal laws as a severe emotional behavioral disturbance and interfering with the ability for the child to progress. They can ask the school system to sort of provide a passport to the new teacher coming in about what works and what doesn't work.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. We have Robert on the line next in Dallas. Hi, Robert.
Hi, how are you guys?
Very well, thanks.
It's such a great conversation. I really appreciate you having this dialogue. I have a comment slash question for the author about what she thinks about kind of parental engagement. Having been in both the education field and now in mental health, what I have seen is so many kids come through the system that appear to have, you know, a lot of serious mental health, behavioral issues. But when you work with the parents, you see that there's so much chaos at home that what we're really asking educators to do is to reparent children who have upset homes due to all kinds of different things. And how is that fair to an educator to try to play both roles of mom and dad and teacher?
What a wonderful question, Robert. So I guess one thing is I think what happens sometimes, though, is that we get into the blame game. And again, this is said with enormous respect for educators, but I just was in a team meeting just today where people were sort of feeling like if only the parent would get this child into bed early enough, then we wouldn't have her falling asleep in class. So there can be an enormous exasperation. And my thought is you can only control your behavior as a teacher. And so you may have in-home therapist or counselor, you or me, working with the family trying to modify things. And then it's about how are you going to shape the behavior of this student when they're in the classroom? Because I don't want to also disempower teachers. I think it's a pretty defeatist view for us to feel like, well, you know what, unless we transplant this kid to another family, he's doomed. That's equivalent to me saying someone comes into the intensive care unit and you look at them and you say, you know what, you're going to, we're never going to fix this and you're going to be in the intensive care unit for the next 8 years. So my sense is, you know, some of the things that we suggest are really concrete, practical steps to support teachers to feel like they can make a difference and an enormous difference despite the kinds of challenges that children and families face. And at the same time, we don't want to minimize that, you know, if you are poor and hungry and there was just a massive fight at home, that you may come in and not be so ready to learn. And so our question would be, okay, you may not know some of those things. Clearly, you'd want them to get lunch or breakfast before they started school. But what ways can you teach this child about how to manage their anxiety? So a practical thing like having a calming box might be something that they could actually bring with them when they're at home, so that if they have a parent who maybe might have a short fuse and tends to, you know, lose it quickly, they have some ways to support themselves.
We have an email here from Albina who writes, how do I help my 7-year-old with sensory integration issues avoid perceiving himself as a troublemaker? He gets notes from the teacher called strikes whenever he gets overly excited.
Huh. So that's a perfect question, because what she's saying is that there's where I would encourage her to be able to help the teacher understand what is sensory motor integration. Some teachers don't know what that is, so they might not recognize that when a child is in a loud recess, that a child with sensory motor integration might end up being a wreck and being kind of overly stimulated in the classroom and bumping into other kids. So again, two quick concrete strategies would be, can they think about having an alternative recess for this little guy where he might be with a smaller group of kids scaffolded with it could be the teacher assistant. We're not saying it's only the teacher. There's not, you know, they can draw on other resources in the school, and that would allow him then to return to the classroom and not be disruptive.
Talk about this. I mean, it sounds like if there is one thing we haven't said this hour that you would argue is necessary, it's better, a greater amount of mental health education as part of the curriculum for teachers.
Yes, I would just, when you poll teachers and you ask them, you know, where's the gap for you? What would you like to learn more about? A lot of teachers would say, I want to learn. It's not just around managing the behavior. It's really about how to understand it and then come in with sort of preemptive strikes to support these students. So, you know, and we are moving in the right direction in the last 30 years. I don't want to sound too doomsday, and we're not reinventing the wheel, but there is a necessity to understand, for instance, how does trauma show up in a classroom? What are the kinds of things that you as a teacher might anticipate with a kid who's had a lot of trauma in their home that may that you may need to have a different approach? And my hope is that we're going to move in the direction with supporting kids who are challenged with mental health problems in the same way with reading, where we have a lot of great interventions now that are systematically employed in schools to help readers. And I would hope that we start to have a nuanced approach to these kids that struggle with their behaviors that's both empathic and bolsters them so that we don't have these kids dropping out of school or alienating their teachers and making it tough for other kids to learn.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. We have Dixie on the line now in Dallas. Hi, Dixie.
Hi, Chris. Hi, Nancy.
Hello.
Hi. I'm a graduate student at Texas Woman's University in Dallas for occupational therapy, and I had to call in because so much of what we're talking about right now in our pediatric semester is behavior, and I'm also a recovering behavior kid, so I had oppositional behaviors and things like that when I was going through school. And I think it's so important what you were saying about identifying the function of the behavior and remembering that all behavior is communication.
Oh, I'm so glad you heard that.
It's so important. And I just wanted to advocate for the teachers in the sense that occupational therapists do work in the school a lot of times. People think of occupational therapists as only working with children that have physical disabilities, but there's a major psychosocial component to occupational therapy. So we are available to help making behavior plans for kiddos or adding in some sensory strategies to their routines and things like that. And it can be really, really effective. So I want to offer to teachers that occupational therapists along with them have the same goals for a lot of these kids and to kind of team up together so that we can work together and combine all of our strategies to really help these kids instead of it being kind of the teachers are on their own or the occupational therapists are working with the child in another room, but really like work as a team of providers with the family and the other specialists in the school to help the child to self-regulate those behaviors, find alternative behaviors, things like that, so that they can manage in school and get the most out of it. I had some really great teachers who knew how to work with me.
Dixie, I'm glad that you are highlighting that, because particularly with the mother who just had called in about her 7-year-old son, that she was saying he has sensory motor integration problems, and what you're highlighting is if she felt like the teacher might not be as receptive to her coming in, she could always say, you know what, make contact with the occupational therapist and see if they could team up together and provide the instruction, maybe not coming from the mother, but coming from someone in the school building that the teacher may be more receptive to.
Under what circumstances, Nancy, would you recommend that for whatever reason, when it appears that it might be better for everybody involved, for a student in mid-year to switch from the classroom of one teacher into another? I mean, on the one hand, it can be very disruptive. On the other hand, if things are just not going well, maybe a switch makes sense.
Well, definitely around safety. Mm-hmm. If a child is physically assaulting other students or teacher has been so worn down by trying to manage it and just doesn't have the energy to put in the intervention. It seems like that's a time when you may want to revisit whether they do go into a therapeutic school setting or a self-contained setting where there are more, you know, hands-on approach to be able to support things. That's certainly a situation where if people are getting hurt, that's not okay. Mm-hmm. And we need to make sure everybody's safe. So that would be, and then I think if there really is a, sometimes you have kids who say have anxiety who need more structure and need more support, and they may be in a classroom with a teacher who's a lot more loose, and the classroom next door has a lot more structure, and you're going to see a child have a better shot at that. So what I would say to parents or to teachers, but particularly to parents, is if you're trying to get your kids switched to another classroom, you don't want to talk about wanting to be in Mrs. Susie's class, but you talk about what it is about the teaching style that would benefit your child.
What can administrators do to help teachers who may be dealing with really challenging students in any particular year?
You know, one of the things that they can do is make sure they have enough time to manage them. Mm-hmm. So that if you have really, the, you know, two or three kids that are zapping the teacher's energy, to be very conscious about what is it that you can relieve the teacher from so that they may be able to have the energy to devote to this. If you're talking about needing an alternative lunch or an alternative recess, that together as a school system, you think about how can we make this happen without it coming, you know, out of the teacher's time. You can help with trying to have protected time that the team in the school can sit down and strategize proactively. So, you know, those are some of the thoughts that I would have about, you know, and that we talk about in our book about what might allow the teacher to have the stamina. Because the students that we describe in the behavior code can, at the onset, when the teacher is gaining the skill level to manage it, can be draining. And we definitely advocate that administrators work closely with teachers. And that can make an enormous difference that a teacher doesn't feel isolated.
And the outcomes for these kids with problems in the elementary grades can be okay if they get some intervention?
Yes, I want to leave definitely your listeners and yourself, Chris, with a sense of optimism. I wouldn't have devoted my professional life to working with these kind of students if I didn't see the kind of change that can happen with thoughtful intervention.
Dr. Nancy Rappaport is Assistant Professor of Psychiatry at Harvard Medical School and co-author of The Behavior Code, a practical guide to understanding and teaching the most challenging students. Nancy, thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure.
Today's show was engineered by Shelley Canavy. Joe Bilotti answers the phones. Christine McConnell produces the podcast. And our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. Learn more about the show, find out about upcoming programs, and download the daily podcast at kera.org/think. Email comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.